You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Andrew Hammond, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you conversations with practitioners, authors, and scholars who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, please reach out to us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. If you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you listen on. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help.
Quite frankly, here we start. Where's your interpreter?
For you or for me?
I have a good friend who hails from Scotland, so I think I might be able to really have no problem. I won't have one, Emily.
You've had some practice. You watched the first five Bond movies.
Yeah, it sounds really good. I actually love the way it sounds, better than Queen's English.
I was thinking that for this podcast, it would be quite interesting to make your friendship the thread that runs through the podcast, because it's quite interesting to me, you know, two gentlemen born on either side of the East-West Cold War rivalry, and both of you now live in Atlanta, I believe. Both of you are now friends, so if you could just help our listeners, take us on a journey. How did you first meet?
That would be up to Keith. With regard to the overall friendship thing, maybe I can chime in. We have identical opinions about that, but Keith tells it best how we met. He initially was present at one of my presentations, and somehow we exchanged phone numbers, and he invited me for lunch. And now Keith, take it away.
No, actually, I heard about this retired former deep cover KGB guy who had a lot of money, and I thought I could get a free lunch out of Jack. Is exactly what it was. It didn't work out that way. I had called Jack about making a presentation to my Rotary Club. Once upon a time, when Jack and I were very actively involved in the intelligence communities from an operational standpoint, we maybe thought different than we do now. I'm at a point in life now where I believe in giving back and service above self. Before, it was all about lying and manipulating to get things that I needed for the U.S. government, and I was really good at it. I'm one hell of a liar and one hell of a manipulator, and that made me a good operator. But nowadays, I'm not that guy. So I called Jack and asked if he would come and speak to my Rotary Club. Best presentation in the history of my Rotary Club. Jack came up, talked about his life and his background and who he is now. But the fun part about the whole meeting with Jack is when I called him, I wanted to meet him face to face before I brought him up to my Rotary Club to speak. And I suggested a place to meet that I thought would be a great place for guys with our background. It's a speakeasy in Atlanta, and it's located, we'll call it within a restaurant. But if you don't know it's there, there's no big sign on the door saying, speakeasy here, follow this path. So I meet Jack for the first time face-to-face in the parking lot of the restaurant. And I say, hey, man, good to meet you. Just do what I do. Just follow me. And so he does. We walk through a very crowded restaurant, and I walk into a walk-in cooler. And Jack walks in right behind me, and the door shuts behind Mr. Barsky. And that's when I will allow him to jump in and tell what his thoughts may have been when that door shut.
And when was this? What year?
Three years ago.
People ask me this question all the time, if I still have concerns about my well-being, so to speak. And the honest answer is there's some residual fear. Like for instance, I run around in the neighborhood here, and there's a stretch that's wooded. And when a car drives at me very slowly through that wooded stretch, I start running in zigzag. Can't help it. But anyway, so that residual fear came up because I didn't know Keith from a hole in the wall, other than, you know, having briefly spoken with him. And he was the enemy, you know, he could be crazy. When that thing shut, I said, oh, my God, this is it.
Here comes the ice pick in the back of the head. But I'm a little guy, and Jack's not. So I would have had to literally jump to catch him. But anyway, it only takes like 5 or 10 seconds. Your eyes adjust, and then Jack can see me walking down a darkened hallway. Couple right turns, and we're sitting at a very small bar, looking out through a two-way mirror at all the people in the restaurant. What a great place for two old spies to be.
Let me chime in here about size. I think smaller men make better spies because nobody notices them. And this is I'm not making that up. My handlers at the KGB, at the point where they decided to send me to the U.S., confided that they had internal discussions as to whether I wasn't too tall. But then again, my talent to get rid of almost 100% of my German accent was so unique that they said, all right, he's going to the U.S., they have tall people. But there was a consideration about height.
How tall are you, Jack?
I'm 6'3".
6'3".
Even today, I'm still one of the tallest people in any meeting. But 40 years ago, people were shorter. You know, I played center in college basketball in East Germany.
And what height are you, Keith?
I'm 5'7".
5'7".
73-ish.
I think it would be really great just for people that aren't acquainted with you both, just to get a better understanding of who you both are. And I thought an interesting way to do this would be if Jack could describe who Keith is and Keith could describe who Jack is.
Absolutely. Jack is Keith, but he's just an East German version and taller.
And better looking.
Okay. I'll give you that because, oh, wait a minute. I've got my glasses off. Nope, you're not better looking. Jack and I, as we got to know each other, we found out we share many of the same exact characteristics, how we were raised, what we believed in, who we became, why we did what we did, and how we got to where we're at today. We look differently. We sound a little bit differently. And yes, we work for the opposite sides of the big old Iron Curtain. But we are one and the same individual. That's how I'm going to describe him.
All right. Let me take that away. I agree with that 100%. We did what we did in the lying and the cheating and the deceiving because we knew we worked for a cause, not for self-aggrandizement, not for money, not out of hatred for one side or the other. We just knew that the cause that we were engaged to support was the right thing. Well, in this case, I came over to Keith's side, 100%, right?
Correct.
There's one distinction though, in that I switched identities. I wasn't an illegal. Keith was not. He had a cover, but you know, when it comes to things like I was partially, one of my tasks was to be a talent spotter. Well, Keith was probably somebody who would take hints from a talent spotter and then try to develop the asset, right? You know, with regard to character traits, mindset, and so forth, we are one and the same. But if we had been on the same side, we would have been colleagues that played different roles, because typically there's, when it comes to particularly, you know, recruiting, running an asset, at least in the KGB, there were always three involved: the spotter, the recruiter, and then the handler. And they didn't know about one another, and they didn't even know what happened to the potential talent. No, I was a spotter, no more, because as an illegal, if you go any further, you endanger your very being.
I use another word. I was what was commonly called the collector. I collected people and information. So you've got to get to the people to get the information. And so I was just commonly called a collector.
But you did recruit assets, didn't you?
Absolutely. That's a big part of the role. You know, nowadays it's all about hacking and tracking software. The kind of work that Jack and I did, you know, I don't know how much of it is really done anymore. Once upon a time, that was the place to be. The human collectors, the people that would recruit assets and gather information, that was where you wanted to be. Now it's hacking. Now it's tracking. It's software. It's technology.
So just to pick up on something Jack mentioned there, would you say that yous were both ideological, what are called ideological intelligence officers or spies, as opposed to just, well, I happened to be American and that was the intelligence service that was there? Or were yous believers in the cause?
Yes. I hated the filthy communist. Come on, I grew up like that. I grew up on this side of the Iron Curtain. My father was a military guy and I was a military guy. I got recruited from the Navy to the intelligence community as a civilian. So I believed it 100%, hook, line, and sinker. Those were the bad guys. Those were the, you know, the evil people that we grew up, the anti-everything that we believed in. Of course, I was ideological.
I got news for you. We were evil. But here's my belief was, I just, not hated, but, you know, I was just out to topple capitalism, which exploited people and suppressed people. So my belief was anti-American, but I couldn't find a lot of Americans when I got here that I actually disliked or hated. but that was interesting in that the belief in that what American was doing wrong in the world took quite some time to get rid of. But, you know, Americans as people, you know, lovely crowd, really.
And could you just tell our listeners just a little bit more about your own story? Where were you born and raised, and how did you end up in the world of intelligence?
Well, it's been a long journey. I was born in a godforsaken corner of East Germany. That was 4 years after World War II. It was the German zone that was occupied by the Russians became the German Democratic Republic. I grew up in the country, okay? The village I was born into had about 1,000 people. I went for a little while to a school that had multiple grades in the same classroom. But I was a bright kid, and that got me out of there. That got me to a boarding school and eventually to university. And I was a great student, too. And so I caught the eye of the KGB. How they found out about me, I don't know. But it is quite clear that at least occasionally, the East German government allowed them to look into the files of people that they kept. And there was a file on everybody. And mine said, oh, good, good, good. Member of the Communist Party, best student, bright guy, leader, blah, 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 blah. And so they introduced themselves one day, and it was a year and a half of mutual, like feeling each other out, until one day in Berlin, I was introduced to one senior KGB guy there, and he bluntly and rather directly asked me the question, so are you going to be in or not? And I said, I wasn't prepared for that. And he wanted, decisive action. He wanted a response the next day, which I gave to him. And I said, okay, I'm in. And so then I got, I don't want to get too much into the story because it gets into, you know, I can go on and on why the decision was not that easy. But I made it. I was trained for 2 years in Berlin, and then we discovered, to my surprise, that I had really good language capabilities. And they just figured, you know, instead of sending me to West Germany, where the Stasi already had 1,000 agents all the way up to high levels in the government, they needed some people desperately as illegals in the United States. So I got 2 more years of training in Moscow until I was finally ready to sort of impersonate an American. And that's what I did. I came to the U.S. in the fall of 1978, acquired all the documentations that you have to live and work in the U.S. and worked for the KGB for 10 years. And then I quit. And I don't want to get into this. Is another part. I have a lot of stories within the story. Quit and became like a normal citizen. I forgot that I was ever a spy, but 9 years after I quit, the FBI found me. And that was a surprise. And so at that point, I had not only lost my dislike of America and the Americans, because I was making, I built my own version of the American dream. But I also had lost my ideological underpinning. I actually was well on my way to become an anti-communist. So for me to cooperate with the FBI was that was a no-brainer. And so 5 years ago, I was awarded citizenship of the United States. And so today, I consider myself legally, intellectually, and emotionally an American. I just have had an unusual way, immigration path.
It's been quite the journey, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. and it's still going on, trust me. There's still a lot of reasons to get up in the morning, in addition to the fact that I have a 10-year-old child.
And one thing, just for our listeners, you know, when you say you were born in East Germany, they'll immediately think of the Stasi. So just to clarify, the Stasi did not run an illegals program. It was only the KGB.
No, they ran the best illegals program ever in history. They, as I said, they had 1,000 people in West Germany, including, just below the chancellor, actually.
Willy Brandt.
The major advisor to Willy Brandt was Günter Guillaume, who was an East German Stasi spy. So they did not really do a lot of active espionage out in other countries. They helped Cuba, for instance, quite a bit. and some other, Warsaw Pact states, but their focus was West Germany, and they did one heck of a job.
And just before we go on to Keith, where were you during this time, Jack? So when you were an illegal, give us a sense of the various locations that you were.
So I really, my playground was New York City, specifically Queens, New York. I couldn't afford Manhattan. Other than that, I traveled around a little bit sometimes in the U.S. and every 2 years, going back to Moscow and for some debriefing and, rest and relaxation. But, pretty much New York. I lived in a neighborhood that was in process of becoming very internationalized. It had an Irish-German background, but when I left, 7 years after I moved in there, it was like a crazy mix of all kinds of different nationalities, all kinds of different restaurants. Yeah, and quite affordable.
And this is really interesting, getting a sense of the story before both of your lives intersect at this Rotary Club. So, Keith, help us understand how you ended up at that Rotary Club. Where were you born and raised, and how did you end up in the world of intelligence?
Well, I am from the world, Andrew. That's the way I always define it. When people ask me where I'm from, I just kind of look down and say, here, at the moment. My father was a career Navy man. And so I was born in a Navy hospital in Portsmouth, Virginia. And we moved 6 months after that, and we continued to do so very frequently throughout my childhood. I graduated from the American high school system after 10 full years, not 12. And in 10 years, I went to 14 schools in multiple states and two countries. The longest I'd ever lived anywhere in my life was in the Philippine Islands. I went in the Navy before I went to college, right after I finished high school. In fact, I finished high school at 16. I had to wait until I was 17 to get my parents to give me permission. Both had to sign papers that allowed me to go in the Navy. So I was in the Navy at 17, stayed in the Navy for just over 4 years, finished most of my 4-year degree while I was on active duty, serving for the squadron and on board two different ships. And I married young, had children young, stayed overseas in Italy, which was now my new home at that time. I'd been in Italy for a number of years with the Navy. My wife at the time was, she's Italian. So I stayed overseas. And I got a little knock, proverbial knock on my door one day from someone who represented the American embassy. And then someone else who represented the organization that ultimately put me on their payroll. At the time, we called that organization NIS, the Naval Investigative Service. Nowadays, they're called NCIS. They've got a really cool and very realistic TV show. But we'll say NCIS for modern purposes. So NCIS did not have any intelligence operations specialist assigned overseas. And the intelligence operations specialist role, the GS-0132 series, is what we put everybody under, no matter who they get assigned to. And so I got sent back to the States for some advanced training, got cross-trained by a number of federal law enforcement organizations, as well as the CIA. And this is where I differ from Jack a little bit. I look at things like terrorism and espionage as crimes. And so part of me has a mindset that you have to build a case that you can eventually take before a court, and you can't jeopardize your case when you're gathering information through the assets that you develop. But the other side of me doesn't give a rat's ass about the case. It's about the information. Expediency. Get what you need to get quickly from whomever you need to get that information. Things that might help prevent a crime from happening. I didn't do this for 20 years like Jack. I left that community to get into the private sector. to get into politics, to get into business, to get into a bunch of other things that I wish to do in my life. I didn't grow up wanting to work in the intelligence community. It happened. For me, it was a job. It was an incredibly interesting job with incredibly talented people around me. And I'm very proud of those years working with the old now NCIS organization. I went on to a career in the private intelligence world, and that is a hell of a lot more interesting and a lot more profitable. You know, these days I don't work for ideology, brother. I work for money.
And well, some people would say that that's its own ideology, but give us a sense of the types of things that you were up to, Keith. So you mentioned assets and collecting in Italy. Like, help us piece it all together.
Absolutely. I did a lot of very extensive liaison work with the Italian version of the CIA at the time, something called CISMI. They've changed that name since. But we did a lot of very good work directed against arms trafficking, terrorism. You know, the Red Brigade were a big problem once upon a time. They had kidnapped an American general, General Dozier. Jack?
Question, did you interfere in the Italian elections?
As much as we possibly could, absolutely.
You're not that old, are you? The 48 elections?
No, not then, but throughout time, we do our best to interfere in elections like others try and interfere in our elections. It's silly. It's juvenile that our politicians make a big deal about this. Hello, that's what intelligence officers do. We did it in Italy. They do it here. We do it all over the world. But some of the active things, and these are interesting things. An individual named Yunsu Okudara, who's still at large, member of the Japanese Red Army, placed a car bomb in front of the USO Club in Naples, Italy. And it was 2 years to the date of the anniversary of when the US Navy had bombed Libya and killed one of Muammar Gaddafi's children. So Yunsu Okudara, who was already wanted, by the way, the year before, he had placed a mortar device and bombed the U.S. Embassy in June of 1987. So we were already looking for him. We missed him that night. And Angela Santos, a U.S. Navy petty officer, a 21-year-old girl who had volunteered to work at the USO Club that night. It was nowhere near where her work location was. It was miles and miles away. She was taking her own time just to be kind. She got killed that night. And people talk about a lot of other victims of bombs, but they seem to forget about Angela Santos. I haven't forgotten about her. I got there to the bomb site very quickly. And again, fortunately, having been trained or cross-trained by federal law enforcement individuals, I'm looking at absolute chaos, and I'm thinking, you've got to protect the crime scene at this point. And so I'm screaming in Italian as loud as I can with my high-pitched voice, trying to get people away from what is now a crime scene. We did some incredible work for 48 hours, by the way. We got into the hotel room where Yunsu Okudara had stayed. We got the records from the car rental company. We knew where he got the nails, basically, that were used around the device. We even know how he got out of Naples. And of course, the FBI shows up, 24 hours later and gave us the classic, we're in charge. It's like, no, the hell you're not. But they wanted to be in charge. We had already done all the great work along with our Italian counterparts. But Yunsu Okudara got away. He ended up in the Bekaa Valley of Lebanon, and to this day, he is a wanted man.
Both of you mentioned your training, and you spoke about the lying, the manipulating, the deceiving. I guess many of our listeners who have not been involved in the world that you were, their question is that they're going to wonder, how do you stop one from bleeding over into the other? How do you stop the professional lying and cheating and deceiving bleeding over into your personal life, where you're lying and cheating and deceiving, or is it very difficult to make that distinction?
The answer is you don't. it sort of sticks with you. Now, the biggest difference in my life is when I did lying and cheating on behalf of the KGB, I hurt some people that were close to me. When I act the way I'm acting now, and I'm still a great manipulator, it becomes part of you. But I am very careful not to do harm. And I, over the years, while I was in corporate America, and now that I've been out of it, and doing speeches and doing all kinds of different things, I think I have collected a very good track record not to do harm with my capabilities. There was one time I was interviewed by a very prominent German journalist, and she said at the end of the interview, she said to me, "Jack, you are a very dangerous person." I said, "I could be, but I'm not anymore." That's my story. I think, you know, Keith has been nodding, so.
There's one other thing that Jack and I have talked about, and we didn't practice it, but we were speaking together once upon a time, and I don't know who said it first, but it became the really thing that united us. Once we got to a point where we fell in love with someone and we understood how powerful love can be, mm-hmm. you have great difficulty harming somebody at that point. And as long as you don't really love anything or anyone, you can be ideological. You can be a jerk for a living. You can lie, you can manipulate, you can deceive, because you just don't show any emotion. You know, I fell in love, and I can't be who I was anymore. And Jack, you know, he ended up leaving the KGB because he fell in love with his child.
Right, right. And you know, I want to echo that. The one thing, and I've been working on something like this, like a presentation that has to do with exactly that topic. And I come to the conclusion, when it comes to love, there's no more deception. There's no more perception management. There's no more manipulation. True love, I'm talking about true unconditional love. It's just raw self. And I have arrived at that in many respects, but you know, when I go out and meet new people, I know how to speak their language. That's very important. And I do speak their language, even though that puts me out of who I am at core. But that's not dangerous to them.
No, but Andrew, don't take it that we got soft. I think we're harder than we ever were, but we just realized some of the emotional things that go into being a man nowadays. We talked about how we were raised. We were very non-emotional. We had mothers who were kind of cold and standoffish, and right. And it's amazing how our backgrounds paralleled one another in different times and in different parts of the world. As we got to where we were, and what made us good eventually could have put a dagger in our own hearts if we didn't learn how to open up a little bit.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. And
And now a word from our sponsor, Sixth Sense. Sixth Sense provides award-winning cloud-based automated endpoint and vulnerability management solutions to streamline IT and security operations. With its advanced platform, businesses gain complete visibility and control over their infrastructure, reducing IT and security risks and optimizing operational efficiency. With Sixth Sense, you'll get real-time alerts, risk-based vulnerability prioritization and remediations, and an intuitive automation and orchestration engine so you can focus on your core business goals, confident in the knowledge that your enterprise is secure, compliant, and running smoothly. Visit sixthsense.com to learn why enterprises choose them.
And just to get a better sense of your parallel lives developing, when were you both born? Are you both roughly the same age, or is there much of a difference between how old both of you are?
I may be older. I was born in 49.
61. Okay. Yeah, it doesn't really matter. But what is really vitally important is that Jack and I grew up with, you know, an ideology. Jack, and we often make the joke, you know, he grew up under communism, but you know, how do you know a communist? They read Marx and Lenin. How do you know an anti-communist? They understand Marx and Lenin. So we understand each other, beautifully. We sound different. We're, you know, I'm short, he's tall. But if people listen to the substance of what we say, and they realize that we did what we did for what we thought was the appropriate cause, but now we understand a little bit better. We understand each other. We understand a little bit more about the world. Espionage is a young man's game. You know, Socrates, I think it was, who said that the sign of a truly wise man is a man who accepts his own ignorance.
When did you first think, I think I'm actually an American?
That was about 5 years into my assignment here. I was working at the time as a programmer for MetLife. And, you know, in those days, the insurance companies were very paternalistic, and it felt almost like I was at home. You know, they really took care of you. And the work was very good. I loved programming. And I worked with a whole bunch of smart colleagues. That was after almost 10 years of either working on substandard jobs, such as a bike messenger, or operating as a lone wolf being trained for like almost 6 years by the KGB. All of a sudden, I was again a member of a team, and I did good stuff. And at one point, I was thinking, because I knew my... According to what the KGB communicated to me, the plan was to have me in the U.S. no longer than 10 years. Apparently, there is a bit of a shelf life attached to an illegal because they do what I did, or at least there's a great risk. That's why they like to send actually couples. I knew I would have to leave the U.S. And that was before my daughter Chelsea was born. But that thought just like started popping up in my head. Said, I'm going to miss this place. And that, when you ask, that was the seed, that was the beginning, because I had become comfortable. That was now my home away from home. And what really nailed the deal for me to stay here was that I had this 18-month-old girl who when they wanted me to go back, I saw no way. There was no risk that was high enough to leave this child.
And that must have been uncomfortable in a way, to feel that seed and then for that seed to grow, because that's something that you weren't meant to feel, and that's something that could potentially be dangerous. Is that right?
No, it's let me tell you something about how I operated. I did not do a lot of deep thinking for a long time. while I was, because you start digging deep, you might find things you don't like. You might be afraid of the situation you're in. There's a whole kind. I was very, very superficial, smart as a whip, but superficial. And that carried forward even into my career in after I left the KGB, because there was also this dichotomy of, you know, being German, being American and all that. And once I was out of the closet, I finally allowed myself to get inside of me. And I've done this now because of lots of interviews and the book that I wrote and starting yet another family. I've gotten to know myself really well. And then it took a so when you asked the question about discomfort, I didn't let that in. I just did what I had to do, and it was, as I said, very superficial. And that's that. And I'm not sure if Keith may have a similar approach to, you have to do what you have to do, right?
Very much so. We all make sacrifices. We make them in the name of a country, the name of our family, the name of whatever we happen to believe in. So it's a series of sacrifices. Looking deep inside, though, which is something Jack and I, we didn't do when we were young men. We didn't want to look inside. That's where you have to face your own truths. And when you're trying to manipulate everybody else to give you their truths, you don't want to know your own truths. But once you do, life becomes much more enriching and much more fulfilling.
Yes.
We form bonds and friendships, old adversaries, truly enjoy spending time together, because we get to look at everybody and realize what BS they're spouting all over the world.
How much of your training do you still carry around with each of you? Give us a better sense of the extent to which that still lives with you.
Let me just start this. What I carry with me as, that was given to me as part of my training is my ability to speak and write English better than German. All this other training, the best part of my training was spycraft, operational training. You don't use that anymore. I'm not going to go around and check whether somebody's following me. I'm not doing secret writing. I don't do any of that stuff. What I carry with me is what I learned while I got into the business. The kind of role I played, the kind of job I had as an illegal, you cannot train somebody for that. You learn this on the job. So with regard to, I really can't think of anything that was, see, the one thing that should have been done and it wasn't done, there was very little cultural and psychological, training. They never even made me take a psych test, nothing. So that I all acquired sort of on the fly by myself. So that's maybe an unsatisfactory answer, but it is what it is. What I still carry with me is like the moments. Because sometimes I walk around in the city and I think, "Ooh, this is a good spot for a dead drop operation." You know,
you know, many people, of course, know about the illegals from the 2010 illegals program, or more recently from watching, you know, the Americans. So I mean, I guess another thing that in a way you carry around with you is your name. Could you tell us a little bit more about that whole process, the name that you were born with and grew up with, and the, you know, the name and the person that you are now? I find that really fascinating.
Well, I was given an unpronounceable German name at birth, so I can't pronounce it, but I won't make you. Anyway, and I became Jack Barsky based on what the KGB did in those days. Frequently, they stole identities from individuals who passed away at an early age. So there was this this great gravestone in a cemetery in Maryland that where one of the diplomats who were actually KGB, Russian Soviet diplomats, found that was found by this fellow, and he managed to acquire a death certificate for Jack Barsky, pretending to be his father. And then somehow he also got, based on that, he got a birth certificate. You know, the United States has never been really, really tight when it comes to security. Still not today. Now the openness is in cyberspace, more or less, or in naive politicians who don't have a problem consorting with Chinese nationals. But anyway, so I was given this birth certificate as a starting point, and then I acquired the documentation, the two important pieces of documentation, driver's license and social security card. You could get a social security number in those days at an advanced age, because there were two groups of workers that were exempt from social security. So you could walk into the social security office and say, I need a card now. I didn't have one because, you know, I worked on a farm. And when eventually the FBI, it was actually the FBI director who made that decision, decided that I would be allowed to stay in the country and eventually become a citizen, they also agreed that I should be able to keep this name, because that name, I was so integrated in American society, it would have been extremely disruptive for me to rename myself, and it would have also caused a lot of damage to my family. They did ask Jack Barsky's parents, who were still alive in those days, sort of for permission, even though there's no copyright to a name, but they, you know, extended them the courtesy, and they were nice enough to say, you can keep it. So, you know, I've been Jack Barsky much longer than Albrecht Dittrich, that's the German name.
Have you ever been to that grave in Maryland?
No, I have not, but I, you know, a couple of journalists visited it and sent me pictures. So, no, it's an interesting grave because it's it has partially inscription in Hebrew. The Jack Barsky's father was an Orthodox Jew, Elisha Lee Barsky. The saving grace for me that his wife, my quote unquote mother, her maiden name was Schwartz. Now, that is probably also Jewish, but it could be German. And so that's the story.
And Keith, how much do you feel that you still carry your training around with you?
The only thing that I continually carry, and I will always carry, is I know that I don't have the ability to think nor feel for another person. I always ask people how they think or what they feel. It's an assumption that people make that kind of angers me. When somebody says, hey, Keith, I know how you feel. It's like, no, you don't. Ask me and I'll tell you. That's a good intelligence operator's trait. You can't think nor feel for another person. We were taught very clearly to ask people a lot of questions so that we could find something that we could, again, manipulate. Ask them how they think, how they feel, and attack from that point. Now, I don't attack. I'm just genuinely curious about people, Andrew. And that is something that gets me out of bed every morning excited like a little kid on Christmas morning. I really get to learn new things about people every day. Some people might call it nosy because I do like to ask questions. But I'm genuinely curious about what motivates people, just as you are asking me questions. It's something I like to do.
Yeah, we have that in common. I tell people these days, you know, I get to know the real good part of my life at this point is that I get to know a lot of interesting people. I don't want to talk about me anymore.
I was going to say that there's something else I've learned to embrace, and I get asked to speak before groups all the time, college kids, companies, all kinds of social organizations like Rotary and such. And I often start off by telling people to give me or ask them to give me 10 seconds and to look at me and put their phones down. And I let them know that I'm probably the greatest failure that they will ever meet. I have failed at more things than most people will ever attend. And I embrace failure. I've learned from failure, and I continue to learn from failure. So it became much easier to talk about myself and my own poking holes in myself as I got a little bit older. Give it time, Andrew. When you get to be our age, brother, you'll find it much easier to talk about yourself.
It's a matter of getting comfortable in your own skin, and that takes time.
What is the basis of your friendship now? You spoke about golf. Are you, do you golf? Do you go for a few beers? Do you chat on the phone? All of the above? Or give us a sense of...
It's intellectual / emotional, because we understand each other. That's one thing this kind of a friendship has that you don't have with people who haven't been in the field. They don't know what it's like. There's no instinctive knowledge of, aha, we don't have to mention some things. They're understood. It's like, what is that? The mind melt. And anyway, it's an instinctive understanding.
We could easily finish each other's sentences if yeah. we're so inclined. Jack and I know how lonely the job could be as well. And we're at a point where we don't want to be lonely. And we choose to share information and talk with each other. And we're old guys. We're harmless at this point. We're not worried about security clearances or operational programs. We talk about our past, but we also talk about our present. And believe it or not, we talk about our futures, our kids, our grandkids, all the things that they're doing in the world, the sorry state of politics, the interesting technological advances, the toys that the spies get to play with now. God, they got great toys out there now, man. Woo! It would be fun.
My final question is, if the three of us were in a bar and a fight kicked off, would it be helpful to be next to both of you?
I have never been physical. I got some self-defense training just in case I wind up with the compromising materials in a place where I get attacked by criminals. But that was it. In my entire life, I had, and that includes, it starts from like when I was very young, about three or four physical fights, all of which I won, and I'm not physical at all.
No, I'm not much of a fighter, but I was a military kid, so the bridge of my nose, it's not flat for genetic reasons.
Another thing, it may surprise for people to hear that this right hand, which is my strong hand, has never touched a weapon. No weapons training. BB gun, the strongest thing I had in my hand.
Wow.
Yeah, again, most operational people don't really do weapons training and everything. That's movie stuff. And Jack and I often laugh about that. Again, but you've got a large part of the budget now that goes to paramilitary people. They're coming out of the military, working for the intelligence organizations. They're the shooters. Operational guys typically don't do that kind of stuff.
And have there been any movies or TV shows that you guys have discussed quite a lot, like the difference between fact and fiction?
Outside maybe of John le Carré, who exaggerates a little bit, but outside of that, there's really nothing, no realistic description of what I did in the world I lived in. That includes the Americans. It's a great entertainment, but totally unrealistic.
Yeah, Andrew, there's nothing exciting about sitting on a rooftop doing surveillance when it's 110 degrees and, you know, and just, you know, watching people at a train station. And it would not be an exciting movie or TV show to sit and to show somebody in front of a keyboard putting reports together for hours on end. But that's a lot of what the job entails. This, putting reports together. That's not exciting. The movies are brilliant. They're fun. They're great, but they're not real. nowhere near real.
No.
The real world of operational espionage is exciting for 10% of the time, maybe. And the rest is administrative drudgery. You want to shoot yourself.
Waiting. And just in my case, it was waiting, just waiting for something to happen. Yep.
The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 non-profit. If you want to donate to the museum, or if you're local and would like to volunteer at the museum, please visit our website at spymuseum.org for more information.